You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, if you've had to wait weeks, even months, to see a psychiatrist, you're not alone. Minnesota is part of a national trend in a shortage of mental health counselors at a time when one in five adults will experience a mental health problem. And the problem is most acute if you're looking for help in rural America and if you'd like to see a counselor of color. So how did we get here? What are the consequences of such an urgent shortage? Two guests this hour to guide us through the conversation. I think your experience with this as a family or an individual who's been seeking mental health counseling would be really important to inform the conversation. If you or a partner or a child have struggled to find mental health counseling, what has it meant to you and your family to have to wait? What happened in the interim? What's the search been like? Talk to us about your experience with having to seek mental health counseling and then having to wait because you've been told there's a shortage and you have to wait for that appointment for weeks on end. I think it'd be important to guide this discussion today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Dr. Catherine Nelson is assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. She's with me in the studio. And Kaz is all right with you.
That's right.
Good to have you. So the president of the Association of Medical Colleges says the shortage is being driven by baby boomers who are in larger numbers seeking mental health counseling. First, I'm curious about why that is, and then whether you agree that that's part of the reason for the shortage.
Well, clearly the baby boomers represent a huge portion of the population. And as they age and face different life challenges and there's less stigma and discrimination about the idea of seeking mental health care, they're looking for appropriate services. And at the same time, we have psychiatrists aging and retiring out of the field. And so that's only part of the issue, but it represents a major factor.
What you said about the stigma is really interesting because I think we all know that there is still people do not want to be completely open about seeking mental health counseling in many situations. And yet baby boomers, what, are leading the way for more transparency? Is that what you see?
Yes, they're part of the solution based on what they're enduring and experiencing. But also, I think subsequent generations, the millennials and the Gen Zers, are talking about this as part of their daily conversations. Oh, I saw my therapist today. Oh, I had a great session. And so I see little by little the conversation changing, and it represents some hope.
Joe, are you there with me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Good, good. Much better, and I can hear you. Dr. Joseph Bianco is with us. He practices family medicine in Ely with Essentia Health. I was going to say, by the fact that we are speaking to you and you're a family medicine doctor, not a psychiatrist, tells us what is going on in rural Minnesota. So what's it like in Ely for people who are seeking mental health counseling?
Well, as a primary care physician, you know, we are all trained in behavioral health and to understand all the nuances of treating people with these conditions. So we are on the front line of seeing folks. We take care of chronic disease, and chronic disease often comes with it, depression, anxiety, all those types of things when people are very, very ill. In the rural settings, and as I was listening to Dr. Nelson, we also have a higher proportion sometimes of our elderly population.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them geographically isolated. And I think social isolation is a big factor out here for many people. Yes, this can happen in an urban setting. People can be socially isolated. But we also see this as a real big factor for folks in our rural community.
Let me explore that for just a minute. Because you live in a small town or because you may live on a farm away from a community center? What's happening with social isolation there?
Well, I think it's both. I think once social isolation and kind of the feeling of being alone goes along with the stigma that you just talked about, knowing small towns who really know them, know each other quite well through various organizations, through churches. The stigma of having a mental illness seems to pervade a lot and stop people from seeking the care that they need. And then also secondarily, when you're looking at our rural communities, people living outside of town, living on farms, living in the woods, and especially for our elderly who've chosen that lifestyle for a long time, but all of a sudden they have a spouse that becomes ill, goes to the nursing home, whatever. That social isolation, that isolation in and of itself is a risk to them, not only for mental illness, for a whole number of other chronic diseases.
What you just said is a really important point to emphasize, Kaz, this idea that you and your partner have been handling the health challenges together. They need some kind of expert care. You're back in, what, in a small community or out on the farm, and now you're isolated in a lot of ways.
That's right. Often people don't even know where to turn because mental health literacy can sometimes be an issue. So they might notice that there is a problem, but they don't know exactly what to do about it. And because it's mysterious, that sometimes can present as a barrier to actually seeking and navigating the care appropriately.
Let me grab a call here from Rich in Shakopee. Hi, Rich. How does this work for your family?
Well, I work in the transportation industry, and so I'm on call, and it's been very difficult to make appointments for counseling for anxiety and panic disorder. And I wish there were more opportunities for some kind of telecommunications or something like that to have a counseling appointment versus having to show up in an office.
That's a really good point, and I know they're doing that with other kind of medical care. Kaz, is there telecommuting therapy going on in your field?
Yeah, psychiatry is one of the unique fields where we can do some of the care that we provide over video conferencing. And of course, there's certain things we need to keep in mind. It needs to be a secure and private connection. We don't just do this over Skype or something like that. We need the appropriate technology. And then, of course, you do get into state licensing issues. If you're providing care to somebody in another state via teleconferencing, you have to be licensed in that state where the patient receiving care is located. But this is really a wave of the future, and I think there's going to be a high demand, and then we're going to have to rise to meet the demand of this type of service.
Aesthetically, just tell me, is it, I mean, I know in a pinch, this is a good way to get the kind of intervention or therapy that you need. Is it how you would design it if you had your druthers? Because isn't there something to being in the same room and having the kind of connection between the patient and the mental health counselor?
Well, we're trained in models primarily where we're in the room with the person and really be able to have that one-on-one in-person contact. But if the choice is receiving care or not, this is a great next choice.
If you've just gotten in on the conversation, we're talking about shortage of psychiatrists, particularly in rural America and rural Minnesota and some of the other rural areas of the states that we broadcast into. Also, a deep shortage of mental health counselors of color. We're looking into why that is, why the counseling shortage has grown the way it has, and some of the ideas for solving that, and then what that means. I mean, where the fix is. Back in federal government funding on this, what can individual communities do about this? And your input is really important to the conversation. If you've been in a situation where you're looking for a psychiatrist, mental health counseling, and you've had to wait, what has that meant for your family? What has it meant for your perception of getting this kind of mental health counseling that's important to picking up the pieces, going on with your life, just everyday life? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Dr. Joseph Bianco with us from Ely and Dr. Catherine Nelson from the University of Minnesota in the studio. To Grace, is that in Miller, Minnesota, Grace?
Oh, no. My last name is Miller.
Okay. Hi, Grace. Okay, good. Good to have your call. So what are you thinking about?
Well, something I've done working in office work in a mental health, and something I've really noticed is working with really underpaid mental health counselors are.
Okay.
especially in the compensation. So they will bill out, you know, for what they're worth with the education they've gotten, and then they're getting half that compensation from the insurance companies, or sometimes even less. And it's so it's hard for them. They can only take certain insurances, or they can only allow it for a lot for a certain amount of clients from one certain insurance company. So it really limits them on the people that they can see and reach out to.
Okay. So, Joe, is this something that you're aware of in your part of Minnesota, that the underpayment is discouraging more people from getting into the field?
Right. I think it's one of the problems. But when we see who is coming to our communities and seeing what they can make in an urban setting versus a rural setting, I think the data does show that there is better compensation within an urban setting. The other part of this is, and I was listening at the beginning of your show when you were talking about the Mayo Clinic as well.
Right.
The same thing applies to our rural communities, because you have people who are professionally trained, have been through college or grad school, and they come and their partner has a difficult time finding employment, especially in some of our rural communities where we are experiencing some increased levels of unemployment or poverty.
This makes
sense. And so it's the
sense.
Same. It's the same issue that we have are having a harder time recruiting these people, both in this payment question and then also these other questions of their partner coming along with them.
Yeah, particularly if you have two medical professionals or someone as we were hearing, Catherine was saying, the trailing spouse, you come with high qualifications too. What does the economy, right, in a small community offer to someone like that?
Right, exactly. A really comprehensive mental health team is not just a primary care physician or a psychiatrist, but it also is made up of a RN, a community health worker, a behavioral health specialist who can do the counseling. So, I mean, that's really a very robust team, but to put all those pieces together sometimes in a small community is very difficult.
Good point here. To Kendra in White Bear Lake. Hi, Kendra. How has this unfolded for your family?
Hi. I thought I'd just call and share the experience we've had recently with our teenage son, who was showing some signs of suicidal tendencies. And we had to call several counselors, clinics, going even through our health insurance, and were told there was at least a 30-day wait. Unless we had an ER visit. And so what it felt to us was that we either had to wait until it got so bad that, you know, we were hanging on to a thread of life, or we were just going to have to put in our time. And so we just felt like that was a really frustrating sign of the lack of mental health counselors available. It seems like the system isn't working the way it should. That people who need the help can't get in when the help is best needed before it's too late.
Kendra, can I ask you what you ended up doing?
We ended up calling our primary care physician and telling her a little bit about the situation, and basically said, we need our son to be seen now. And she was able to connect us with a counselor who happened to have a cancellation.
Kat, this is probably not the first time you've heard this. What about this?
No, certainly there's emergency rooms and then there's outpatient programs, but the wait for an outpatient program could be as much as 6 months, depending on what the clinic is offering and what the needs are of the individual. And we see time and time again people sort of in this gap area between absolute crisis where emergency services are appropriate and outpatient care. And we're trying very hard through advocacy and building our system to fill in those gaps, but it's been a slow and difficult process for a lot of different reasons, shortages of professionals, some of the reimbursement issues alluded before through insurance. All of those pieces are coming together to make this a slow process.
Kaz, the ER, Joe, if I might here, the ER is not the best place for most people, is it, who are seeking some kind of psychiatric care?
Ideally, the system would have services to intervene before something comes to an absolute crisis point. If it is an emergency, we want to encourage someone to seek emergency services because we absolutely need to respond to any kind of crisis. But yeah, we don't want to have to wait for an emergency for there to be an appropriate intervention.
Joe, forgive me, you were going to say.
Yeah, I want to just make 2 points about for what this caller, the situation this caller was describing. There is innovation going on in this. I think out in Massachusetts, there is some work going on with mental health urgent centers. Just like we have the convenient care, the urgent centers for coughs and colds and sneezes, they are developing those simply for mental health from an idea of diverting people from going to emergency rooms, where it really isn't the best place to get these types of services, so that people can drop in at all hours in order to get these services. So I think that's an innovation to look into. Secondarily, here in Ely, when people come into our emergency room and there might be a substance use issue or a severe depression or somebody with schizophrenia, we are able, through telehealth services, to get psychiatrists and counselors on the on a video feed to us right directly in the emergency room. So we're able to get a consultation right at that time in real time.
Oh,
and that's
good.
A real plus.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to check this with both of you. I was reading that there was a cap on federal funding for psychiatric medical residency programs, and this cap goes all the way back to 1997. Kaz, is that right?
Yes, and as a director of one of these residency programs in psychiatry, so this is that training that happens after medical school where you learn to be a psychiatrist, this shortage of funding has been a major bottleneck in getting people trained into psychiatry so they can go out and serve our community. And this is particularly a problem now because interest in psychiatry among medical students is raising nationally, but especially in Minnesota. We have higher than the national average medical students saying psychiatry is the field for me. And to not have enough spots because of funding issues to offer these future psychiatrists to be able to stay and serve our state has been very painful, and we're working very hard on this.
I mean, this is a budget decision that was made 21 years ago. It's that far out of date.
Yes, and it's a big issue to tackle, which I think is why it hasn't really been addressed at a federal level, because it would be a huge and complex project that would require a lot of bipartisan collaboration in order to have a good outcome. And so right now we're making do, and many hospitals are actually footing the bill above and beyond what the federal government is providing to be able to support expanded training. So that's where we're putting our energy, asking hospital systems, even the state legislature developed a primary care expansion grant for primary care providers and psychiatrists to be able to fund the addition of residency slots. And so there's some of these unique mechanisms that we're pursuing, but it doesn't ultimately solve the broader issue.
If you've just gotten in on the show, you're wondering what we're talking about. It's a discussion sparked by a piece that one of our reporters, Elisa Roth, did about the shortage of mental health counselors and psychiatrists, particularly in rural America and rural Minnesota, and why that is and how that affects families and people who are seeking mental health counseling. Dr. Catherine Nelson with us from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Joseph Bianco with us from Essentia Health in Ely. And your experience with this, important to the arc of the conversation here. If you or a partner or a child has been struggling to get mental health counseling, what has it meant to your family to have to wait? What are you told when you call up to make an appointment? 651-227-6000 and on Twitter at CarrieNPR to John in St. Paul. Hi, John. Thank you for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. There's a huge shortage, and a huge backlog to see people, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, insurance companies do not reimburse to see people over video conferencing or over the phone, so we have to see people face-to-face. We're restricted to metro areas, and it's hard to see people out in rural counties. Also, homelessness is difficult, so even if they're within reach, when you've got people that have chronic homelessness and comorbidities, it's very challenging to get a hold of them and to maintain contact.
John, you sound like you are a healthcare provider. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I appreciate the call, and you've raised something I wanted to talk to Joe Bianco about. Joe, I know that you are an advocate for thinking of mental health in like a 360-degree way, that you're not going to that you're not going to be able to solve mental health problems if, as suggested by our caller, somebody doesn't have consistent housing or they're not getting enough to eat. How do you approach that as a family doctor?
Oh, that's a terrific point. I think one thing that is happening, and that we're across the country, and there's a lot of work being done in creating community care teams. In 2013, after the Affordable Care Act, Minnesota was allowed to get a state innovation grant. And up here in Ely, we applied for it and we got it. And since that time, we have been hiring community health workers. Instead of patients coming to us within our clinic, these community health workers are spread within the community of Ely to go to places where they know that people who are in need, have some of these social determinants of health that are affecting them. They'll go to the local housing department here, where people are getting low income housing, and they're going there and they're screening them for behavioral health issues like depression or anxiety. Wow. Right,
it's good.
There.
It's really good.
You know, so they're able to go out and reach out to them. We have a community health worker in our school. We have a community health worker that's being hired by one of our local churches, and we have a couple of them in our clinic. So, like, when I have an issue with a patient and I'm in the office, and the patient may have depression, but they may also be without a job, they may be having issues with food or housing or any other things, I can just go down to the hall and bring in the community health worker, who can then start working on all these other factors that really are burdens for people in their lives, and it makes it very difficult for them to address not only their depression, but maybe some other chronic illness that they might have. So these are new models that are coming up to address some of the issues that this
That sounds remarkably well coordinated, given what we hear about the kind of piecemeal care that often. Cass, do we have a model like that here in the Twin Cities?
There are lots of individual places pursuing some of these innovative models. Some of the barriers do come down to funding, so I'm delighted to hear that there were grant support for some of these innovations. I mean, with healthcare all the time, sometimes thinking out of the box can be very helpful. So, for example, you can cut down on emergency room visits by supplying air conditioners to people so they can stay safely in their home, but there's not really a place you can bill for an air conditioner. So some of these examples.
From Leticia on Twitter, I'm bipolar. A year ago, I was on the verge of a breakdown. I sought help, but was told I wasn't sick enough. Two weeks later, I tried to kill myself. Just having an attempted suicide on my record has opened the door to help I couldn't get before my attempt. That doesn't sound right, Kaz. What's going wrong there?
No, there's something very wrong about that. And clearly our emergency services are set up to respond to very dangerous situations. And sometimes you see that where people get to the point of engaging in dangerous behavior in order to access it. And we have to do better.
A call here from Joy in St. Paul. Hi, Joy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Of course, glad you called.
I was just calling because I had an experience where I had been through a second trimester miscarriage. And I had been through repeated miscarriages before that, and I called my OBGYN, and I tried to get antidepressants because I was really struggling, and she told me that I was too high-functioning. And so I wasn't able to get them from her, and it was just a real strain on my marriage, and it's really hard to advocate for yourself and call a bunch of different clinics. When you're feeling really depressed, and I was already high-risk because of postpartum depression and having had a history of miscarriages. So she referred me to a counseling clinic, and they told me I would have to see a psychiatrist, and the wait was really long. And it was finally my mom who told me, you know, you should just call a primary care doctor. And it was my primary care physician. I didn't even need to explain to her my whole history. She just said, absolutely, you need antidepressants. And I was just shocked that my OBGYN wasn't willing to give them to me because she said I was too high functioning. So it shouldn't be that hard to get an antidepressant.
Agreed.
If you need one. And it really helped me. So.
I'm curious about what our family practitioner hears in that. Joe?
Oh, I'm so sad that she had to go through all of that in order to get care. Yes, I mean, we primary care is trained to recognize depression and many, many other behavioral health disorders. It is oftentimes the first place that people come. Most people come to primary care before they can get help. with these disorders. And one of the obligations of primary care, whether you're coming in for your diabetes or you're coming in for a physical examination, is to screen people for behavioral health disorders. Every patient that comes into our clinics gets screened with a test called a PHQ-2, which is two questions regarding depression. And if they answer those questions in a positive way, one of the two, then they go on to another series of questionings. And if they answer one of those questions regarding potentially hurting themselves, then they go on to another screening. These are all very proactive ways to try to find people who may be having terrible problems with depression or even contemplating suicide. But I really want to emphasize that primary care, a good primary care clinician should be able to recognize and treat the majority of many of these behavioral health.
So, Joe, I'm really glad this has come up because I've wondered about this. I happen to be having an annual exam today. And yeah. Yes, I've been asked those questions, but they seem so, if I wasn't ready to reveal that, I'm not sure those questions are enough to prod me to say something. Now, my physician, love her, and I think she'd be perceptive enough to pick it up. But I'm not sure those questions on a form would get it done.
Well, these are evidence-based. We use the Clubmia screening tool, and maybe Dr. Nielsen can talk
sure.
about her experience with that as well. But I what the evidence shows, and because these have been studied quite markedly, is that they are a way to pick up people who are suicidal or to pick up depression. We know, I think, I'm not perfect on this data, but I think 1/4 of all people who commit suicide have been seen by a primary care clinician within the previous 30 days. So this is one of our reasons to try to pick this up,
okay.
to try to do the screening.
Cass,
and maybe Dr. Nielsen can
sure,
comment
yeah.
on this as well.
Cass?
Well, the screening tools are just there for that as a safety net. And certainly not everyone's going to feel safe or ready to endorse some of those items, but it will catch people who are ready. But I think your point, Carrie, is important that people need to feel safe in the context of their medical care. There should be space created to explore questions like, how are you doing, not just what's your blood pressure. And I think there's a hunger for that kind of connection for people with their care teams. And it can make a difference if somebody's not ready to really talk about something.
So you're pretty convinced that these somewhat wide open screening questions headed right at depression are effective? You think they
They're effective as a safety net, and we definitely catch people that maybe we wouldn't have if we didn't ask the question directly.
Okay. Call here from Mickey in Blaine. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. What'd you want to say?
I just wanted to offer my input. I am an ER nurse in the cities here.
Yeah.
And we see probably 50% of what we see come through our emergency room is mental health based.
Wow.
So adults and children. Mm. And I know just from having the struggle of trying to do my daily job that they're not getting, like, their care is so truncated. Because, you know, you come in and we medically triage you and clear you, and then you wait to see an assessor and the doctor. And then, you know, it's like a 5 to 8 hour process in the emergency
wow.
room.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
You know?
Man.
Yeah. So, and they're not, you know, and they're in a room, you know, by themselves. It's a very tough thing. I can't even imagine. I know from working it's a tough day, but I can't imagine having a crisis and trying to sit in a room with no support or, you know, with minimal things to try and get through something like that.
Yeah. So again, from your observation, the ER, unless you're really in the midst of a crisis that needs instant intervention, is not the place.
No, it's not, because we can only do so much. We're there. I mean, our job is essentially to keep those people safe and until they can be dispositioned to either go home with resources or they have an admission or something along those lines.
Really good for the view from the ER, Mickey. Thanks for the call. A question here that's coming up on Twitter. A listener says, please tell us why the same programming for mental health isn't available in rural counties as in the metro. Is it because we don't pay into something? As a council person and politically active resident, I'm curious how we can do better. Joe, could you tackle that?
Well, you're talking about programming. I'm not exactly sure what they're referring to.
Availability of programs, I think.
Day treatment, perhaps.
Yeah.
Every community has basically a different network, and it all depends on the resources of the community. Again, I'm going to refer back to the innovation grant that we got and what we created. We created a community care team with a shared release of information. So that allowed our health coordinator, our community health worker, I should say, be able to talk to various agencies in our community about a particular patient through this shared release of information. And so by utilizing this, we're utilizing other programs within the community in order to coordinate the total overall care for that patient. This is an innovative piece that we did, but we've demonstrated through doing this a 50% decrease in our emergency room visits
and as well as
a 50% decrease in our hospitalizations, because we are utilizing other entities within the community itself that deliver health, though it might be food or housing or counseling, but be able to coordinate it all together in a seamless cloak has really, really made a difference.
Hey, Joe, I was curious about this CentraCare Health grant. When you talked about a grant, is that the one you were talking about?
No, this is a SIM grant, State Innovation Model. Yeah, this came out of the Affordable Care Act, and the state of Minnesota was one of the 16 states that got it. So we applied a number of years ago. Out of the Affordable Care Act are a number of different innovative programs through the Center for Medicaid Innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really provides some of this work to go on. And I think there has been a lot of really great work trying to address the problems that your callers are pointing out in some of these new innovations.
Michelle in Minneapolis called to say there's a walk-in counseling center on Chicago Avenue near Children's Hospital, free and anonymous mental health care during clinic hours. Kaz, in the introduction, I talked about how difficult it is to find a mental health counselor of color. Is the programming that you're doing, and given what we've said are the constraints of funding here, is there some innovation going on in how to address that?
Yes, absolutely. I can speak directly from the standpoint of even our medical school has been working very hard to increase the diversity of the physicians that the medical school trains. So specifically, there are identified groups that are underrepresented in medicine, like African-American, Latinx, Hmong, American Indian, and Pacific Islanders. Historically, their recruitment to our medical school and matriculation has been about 8 to 10%. We're now up to around 17 to 18% of the class from these...
At the U of M.
From these underrepresented groups. And then beyond that, for residency training, we're putting enormous effort into recruiting and retaining underrepresented in medicine psychiatrists so that they can best represent the community that they serve.
But then you're in rural Minnesota like Joe Bianco and you're dealing with numbers like that and then trying to attract somebody of color to go out into rural Minnesota.
Right. And that's an enormous challenge.
Even more challenging. To Rachel in St. Cloud. Hey, Rachel. Hi.
Hi, Carrie.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking about.
Hi. So I am a psychotherapist with CentraCare up in St. Cloud, kind of in a rural area.
Okay.
And I work as an integrated behavioral health provider. So myself and about 9 other colleagues between psychotherapists and psychologists were embedded into primary care clinics, some specialty clinics as well. And it's been a really great way to improve access. We're available same day for appointments, and our providers... if they have somebody who comes in with a mental health concern, we're right here. So instead of the burden being on them, they're able to pull in a provider right on the spot through a warm handoff. And we often see people kind of for shorter visits, and sometimes it's more about triaging them to outpatient settings, but able to bridge care in the meantime so that they are seeing us while they wait to get in for that longer waiting period. It's been really effective.
Rachel, did I hear you use the term warm handoff? What is that exactly?
Yeah, so a physician can come out. We're usually right there at the nurse's station, and they can give us a quick rundown of what's going on and then bring us into the exam room, introduce us, And right there on the spot, we do either a session if that person has time. Sometimes it's more talking about what would be most helpful as far as seeing a traditional therapist or kind of coming in to see us in this role. And we can just do it right there, right then, rather than putting in a referral and waiting.
Oh. Hey, really, I'm glad you caught the show and that you had a chance to call in.
Yeah, I'm so glad, too. I was excited to be able to share what we're doing here at CentraCare. It's
been
really effective, and all of our clinics are waiting to get their own integrated health providers. So it's been real great.
Joe, question here from Jamie on Twitter, who asks, the last 20 years has seen federal legislation requiring mental illness coverage by health insurance three different times. She's curious about how increased access is affecting the demand that we've been talking about this hour. Do you know?
Right. So, again, yes, we're seeing increasing suicide rates. We're seeing increases in many of these issues. Again, access, the integrative care model that we were just hearing about at CentraCare allows for people to get in quickly. They might not have long-term longitudinal care at one place because that affects access, but people can at least be triaged immediately, treated for whatever emergency might be going on, and then referred to further treatment. These are all ways to improve access for people in the rural communities. And again, we're seeing increasing demands for this along with decreasing amount of providers.
Jeez,
so we have to be innovative in changing this. Again, trying to stabilize people by giving them immediate access. And again, also then utilizing the expertise of our psychiatrists through telehealth as being kind of a hub with spokes going out to various different clinics.
Listen to this, Kaz, from Lori in Chaska. She says, I have a teenage daughter with mental health issues. We've had problems trying to find consistent care for her. We've had to jump around and try different doctors. She says, I know Minnesota is good about mental health care in comparison to the rest of the country. But that's not an excellent situation either if you're having to call different people and the daughter is interacting with people that she isn't familiar with. Why does that happen?
Well, I'm really glad that Lori brought up the idea of a special urgency with need to ChildNet adolescent services.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about this shortage as a whole, but it's particularly profound when it comes to young people. And this is a group that's impacted by serious mental health conditions that can be fatal in some cases when it comes to suicide. And so I think because it's high risk and there's a low number of highly trained people to do a good job with this, it results in different providers saying, you know, I don't feel equipped to this, or this is sort of over my level. And then where do people turn at that point? It's very difficult.
What makes providing mental health services to adolescents more high risk than any other patient population?
Well, it can be high risk, but there's it's the nuance of providing the services. So often there is additional training necessary in order to do an excellent job with that age range.
And you mean so, on top of your psychiatric training
yes.
and residency?
Yes. Most psychiatrists would do a child and adolescent fellowship, which is an additional 2 years to have that specialty level training for that population. And so they're even rarer than your general psychiatrist.
Can you imagine the shortage of people with that expertise where Joe, are you familiar with that?
Yes. What I was thinking about with that, one of our challenges with child and adolescent is that if a child has to go away to be hospitalized, they come into our emergency room, but they need an inpatient bed. The lack of beds is really a big problem. We've had to send people from Ely all the way out to Thief River Falls in order to find a bed. As you know, that's all the way across.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And, you know, so you're already taking a child who might have a precarious social situation or family situation and then removing them so far away from their family. And then oftentimes the family doesn't have the resources to visit because it's so far away. It's really quite a challenge. And then subsequently, once they get back to the small community, what services do they have available that is this extra expertise regarding child and adolescents that are in the small town? That, again, is where the telehealth, telemedicine component potentially can come in to allow them to continue with their counseling, continue with their psychiatric consultation once they're back in the small community.
Joe, I know you're a busy man, busy doctor. I really appreciate the time today. Thanks much.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm going to try to squeeze Katie in Minneapolis here. Katie, I have about 90 seconds, but I wanted to hear what you said.
Hi. Yeah. So I just moved to Minneapolis from Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And,
welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been great. So I moved here to work in the Department of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the UNIVM Medical Center.
Uh-huh.
And I have ADHD. And so I have an MSW. So my degree is in social work, and then I have a PhD in social work. And I say that in that I have a lot of systems literacy and a lot of health literacy. And it
yeah.
took me 2 months to get the medication that I need
wow.
for a document. And I say that because I'm, you know, quote unquote, an ideal patient. So I'm a white woman with hyper levels of education. And that speaks to like a whole bunch of inequities and social assumptions and the ways that we allow people to be ill or not, or how we sort of allow people's bodies to exist. But I think this also speaks to the inequities in, you know, in recruiting more healthcare providers of color. I went to 8 years of graduate school.
Katie, I am so sorry. We're at the end of the hour. I promise you more conversations about it. And thank you so much for the call. Kaz, thank you.
Thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.